Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with Michael Perlman. He's a professor of economics at California State University, Chico, and author of 13 books, most recently The Class Warfare in the Information Age, The Invention of Capitalism, and Transcending the Economy, and forthcoming Corporate Capture of Creativity. Welcome, Michael Perlman.
Well, thank you.
Now, I want to, the book that first caught my attention was The Class Warfare in the Information Age, and that you really take a strong swipe at the notion that the information revolution has fundamentally transformed the nature of capitalism. You think it's pretty much the same old thing?
Yes, yes. I mean, if I see a great deal of continuity. If I were going to look at a fundamental technological change, it would be the telegraph. But even that is a not terribly different thing than what we had before. The market's still the market. The class relations are still the class relations. And the technology doesn't change all that much. The telephone was very, very important. The internet may have will have some uses, and it will create changes, but other technologies have in the past.
And one of the things that you deconstruct in the book Class Warfare is the alleged productivity gains from the information economy. I've seen a lot of critiques of the investment in information technology in different kinds of industrial sectors, and there appears to be an inverse correlation between investment in information technology and actual productivity, belying the notion that we've entered a new phase here. But you also critique it from a kind of social standpoint in terms of the counterproductive nature of a lot of the information that's out there.
Yes. One thing I should say that you're referring to something that's popularly referred to as the productivity paradox. And that held very, very well until about 1995. From 1995 till recently, till the present even, productivity has really soared. And so many people are taking heart from this and saying, this proves that there is a new economy. I think it's something in the middle, that is, the new technology will have productive implications, but they won't be as revolutionary as the optimists believe.
Hmm. And you also point to things like advertising and currency speculation databases as not necessarily being the kinds of productivity that actually contribute to human welfare.
No. And all they do is they give the corporate marketers better access, better leverage to try to manipulate people. I don't think it adds to productivity. It adds to, well, it will add to measured productivity. And this was one of the topics of the new book that we were going to discuss, The Corporate Capture of Creativity. And that is, we measure productivity in terms of dollars. So to the extent that they can manipulate us better, $1 worth of cost of production turns into an extra amount of value in terms of the final price. The classic example would be your Nike tennis shoe, which costs a couple bucks to produce and everybody knows sells for more than $100. Now, that shows up in the data as a productivity increase. But I don't think anybody with an ounce of common sense would really call that an increase in productivity. Productivity would be, at least from my perspective, having to do with an increase in social welfare, an increase in actual physical well-being.
Mm-hmm. So have you been involved in these discussions around gross domestic welfare kinds of measures as opposed to gross domestic product, having alternative economic measures?
I followed them. Anything you do like that, any time you try to reduce a complex society to one simple number, you're really doing, you're involved in an oversimplification.
Mm-hmm.
You can make corrections that can steer you in the right direction, but the problem with all these measures is they give you a false sense of exactitude.
Mm-hmm. Is computerization and robotization, you talk about the productivity increasing in the last 5 years, and it sounded like you were skeptical of the notion that the information technology was actually doing that. One of the things, I'm a utopian socialist, and so I've often looked forward to the day when necessary labor was whittled down to, you know, me having to take out my garbage, basically. Is robotization and automation actually fundamentally transforming work? Are skilled jobs being eliminated because of information technology?
Well, skilled jobs are always being eliminated because of technology, and other jobs are being upskilled. Now, I tried to deal with this in an earlier book that you mentioned, Transcending the Economy. The subtitle of it was Capturing the Potential of Passionate Labor, which refers back to Fourier, with whom I'm sure you're familiar.
Yes.
And there, what I tried to do is I tried to go through all the various wastes and lost opportunities in the economy, and I just gave a rough estimate that I think that probably 1 out of 10 hours in our economy, and this is probably an overestimate, is actually producing anything. That is, most of the effort in our economy goes to keeping score, guarding stuff, and billing and manipulating rather than actually producing anything of any value.
Which is why a lot of studies show that shortening the work week actually doesn't have a productivity impact, because people just eliminate the unnecessary stuff that they're doing at work, theoretically.
Theoretically.
Yeah. One of the debates that you address in your book is about the way in which technology may extend or enhance the control of our society by hierarchical forces, that is, corporate, the wealthy, and so forth, government. And a lot of the debate about information technology has been between techno-utopians who see these technologies as having intrinsically liberatory and democratic impacts on society, and those who are more critical, seeing them as being used for extending the control of capital. And then there's this middle ground of critical folks who say, well, it could be one or it could be the other. It depends on how hard we fight, and maybe it depends on the particular technology. You seem to be coming down on the side of the it's going to extend control, and that there's not very much evidence that it's democratizing anything.
Well, all I've said was that we haven't fought the good fight yet. I mean, I would think that the technology could be used for good purpose, but it won't. I mean, just a week ago was the Super Bowl, and I understand that they used rapid cameras to scan the faces of every person who entered into the arena to see the football game, and then scan those and compare them to a database of criminals, hoping to capture criminals. Well, the implications for this are just ominous. So all this technology is being developed, but it's being developed with the intention of using it for a bad purpose. The technology itself is indifferent.
That seems like a pretty good example of what you refer to after Foucault as the panopticon, the panopticization of society, that information technology will allow these enormous databases to be created that will predict and subcategorize every part of our behavior.
Yes.
And
yes.
Criminal justice is just part of that.
Criminal justice is part of it. Part of it is that more and more you're seeing magazines, every once in a while a magazine that I get will have something, an ad that will be personalized for me,
mm-hmm.
and you're getting this micro-marketing. So it goes in all sorts of directions. Now, this technology has the potential to be turned to very, very good use, but so far, the political pressures aren't there to force it to turn that way.
I'm speaking with Michael Perlman. He's a professor of economics at California State University, Chico, and a trenchant critic of techno-utopian hype. You're pointing out, and again in the book Class Warfare, you point out that there's a contradiction between the classic capitalist top-down command and control model of corporate organization, business organization, social organization, and the radical democratic potential that you see possible through these information technologies. In fact, you make an argument that there may be a contradiction between that top-down control and the complexity of these technologies, because we may need to decentralize in order to deal with these technologies. Is that, do I get that right?
That you, well, I would think that the technology, the real advantage of these technologies would allow for decentralization where decentralization is appropriate, for centralization where centralization is appropriate. For example, nobody would want to have backyard post offices where everybody would have their own post office. That would be foolish.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, for environmental controls, you would need some sort of mix. You would need a very sensitive analysis of what's going on locally, but you would also have to be concerned with the effects globally. Say, water use would have to be monitored very much in a decentralized way, but you'd have to take cognizance and take action regarding the systematic use of the water.
It's kind of complicated because in some cases, information technology seems to, rather than decentralizing or centralizing, it seems to just eliminate middle people. So that, for instance, instead of having to go to a travel agent, we go to Yahoo. And so all 200 million Americans could get their airline tickets off of Yahoo. And we do that as individuals, so it's decentralized in that way, but it's centralized into Yahoo. Is that the kind of nature of this technology?
Well, I think that's the nature of the way technology is developed. That is, if you look as an economist at the history of the development of capital, and I'm thinking here of physical capital, not capital in the metaphorical sense, that mostly it is directed toward eliminating labor. One example that came out very, very clearly was when the energy crisis hit, first in 1973. Before then, there was absolutely no effort whatsoever to minimize or conserve energy. So, for example, one of my favorite stories was at Dow Chemical Company. And if someone knows the reference of this, I remember reading it, I thought, in the New York Review of Books, and I thought that the author was Emma Rothschild, but if someone else has another reference for this, I'd love to find it, that Dow Chemical Company in Midland, Michigan, discovered when the energy crisis hit that they had not ever turned off their electric sidewalks, which they used to melt snow during the winter, during the summer. They left it on. Now, had there been a comparable waste of labor where somebody was hired to do, say, shovel the snow during the winter, but sat on a chair during the summer, that would be unthinkable because business, by its very nature, is directed merely toward reducing labor costs, first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
That's a psychological mindset. So I don't think we should be surprised that that's the way it's being used with the so-called new technology or information technology.
You've given a lot of attention to the growth of intellectual property rights, and of course, you're prescient in pointing out that this was going to become an issue, and it's certainly blossomed with the debates over Napster and the Human Genome Project, many other issues. People are trying to patent business practices, ways of tossing baseballs, all kinds of things out there. And you make the argument that the more we have intellectual property rights protected in the economy, the less efficient our economy is going to be, the less fruitful and productive all of the economic activity is going to be, because people will be denied and have to pay high tariffs for those inventions. Is that
not only high tariffs, Jay, mm-hmm. but in addition, the litigation mm-hmm. will be incredible.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, if you look at, to get a feeling for the relationship between high technology and intellectual property at the development of the radio. And the histories are almost identical. And what happened was, in the radio industry, there was a horrendous amount of litigation, and the actual inventors got almost nothing out of it. But the litigation was so wasteful, creating just a maelstrom of costs, that the Navy stepped in. Franklin Roosevelt was the Undersecretary of the Navy, and the Secretary of the Navy was in Europe at the time. Because of the war, the Navy stepped in and said, no, enough of that. And they created a company, namely the Radio Corporation of America, RCA, which is now part of General Electric. They created a company. They had all of these other companies fold their patents into this one company, and they shared the revenues, because the Navy felt that this technology was very important and it wouldn't get anywhere because it had been blocked by the litigation.
Hmm.
So not only do you have the problem that here is a system that violates the very simple doctrines of economics, and I'll get to that in a second, but it doesn't work because of the litigation. That is, how do you know who created any particular technology? Because science itself is a cooperative, collective, communicative system. So virtually no invention ever comes from a single individual. It comes from a long, long process. Usually basic science is developed, and 20, 30, 40 years later, you have a process that comes out of that basic science. A lot of people are working on it at the same time. Now, the interesting thing about intellectual property, and what I talk about in the intellectual property book, was that the corporations were against intellectual property. And all of the libertarian economists were against intellectual property in the late 1800s. They were against intellectual property in part because the inventions were being made by independent inventors outside of the corporations, and they wanted to get it for nothing. What happened was, in the late 1800s, you had the antitrust laws passed, and patent pools represented the best alternative to a corporate control where a small number of corporations could get together and fix the market. So that was one reason. The second reason was that the corporations, because of the nature of the technology that they were using, were starting to develop some inventions themselves. And the third thing that happened was the laissez-faire belief in the economy fell apart in 1873 when you had a prolonged depression, probably as severe as the Great Depression of the 1929. So all those three things came together, and suddenly you got this idea of intellectual property. Now, let me get back to this question about economics, because I think it's inconceivable to me that people who support the free market would be in favor of intellectual property. Intellectual property is, of course, a monopoly, and a monopoly is antithetical to the whole idea of
a guaranteed temporary monopoly.
Pardon?
A guaranteed temporary monopoly, right?
A guaranteed temporary monopoly, but the length of the monopoly is extending and extending and extending. And what you do is you make a minor change in the technology, and then you reclaim the monopoly and extend it. So the patent law is forever, the length of these patents and copyrights are being extended all the time.
In pharmaceuticals, you invent a slightly better version of the drug and remarket it.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And I have a long, long chapter about pharmaceuticals, which I think is a prime example of the abuse of the whole process.
In corporate capture of creativity?
Yes, yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. But the whole idea of economics is that everything is to be priced at its marginal cost, and that competition should force prices down to marginal cost. Now, if that were to happen, say, in computer software or pharmaceuticals, or anything else, if there were that type of competition, prices would fall below the break-even point. And the reason is that you have a large upfront investment. And in the late 1800s, this was the case with the railroads. The railroads would go, you could see it this easily with railroads or with airlines. There's a big investment. How much does it cost to carry another ton of coal, to put another ton of coal up on the train? Almost nothing. So the railroads would compete, driving prices down, and then they couldn't afford to pay off their creditors. So the whole structure of the modern economy negates the rationale for a market. Markets can't work in this situation. Markets will self-destruct. Another recent book I did was there were two. One was The End of Economics, where I went through the history of the American economy and showed how every time we go to laissez-faire, these markets start self-destructing. And then when they self-destruct, they fix it up. And then once they're fixed up, people get overconfident. They go to the market and then create another depression. And then I did a book called The Natural Instability of Markets. And in that book, I went into the theoretical explanation of why it just wouldn't work.
It's interesting that since the collapse of the Eastern Bloc, you've had this enormous case study of what happens when you have free market economics without a viable nation state with viable laws. Of course, you had some of that going on in many third world countries as well. Yeah. But here were a bunch of educated folks over there in Eastern Europe who look somewhat like us. And we thought that they had everything going for them to become a capitalist economy, but they didn't have the right kinds of laws and they didn't have the right kinds of law enforcement. And it all falls apart. And it seems like this is one of the glaring blind spots in libertarian American economics is their inattention to the importance of a functioning nation state with that protects and creates and invents, as you another one of your books, The Invention of Capitalism, that invents the infrastructure for capitalism.
Not just invents the infrastructure for capitalism. There's something else that that these people who went and tried to liberalize these Eastern European economies, there's something else that they forgot. And that is markets themselves, as we know markets, are not free markets. There's a whole array of customs and traditions and regulations that keep markets from responding too quickly. And if a market is left on its own, then it becomes a highly unstable type of arrangement. And as an example of that, I would have you turn to what happens in the foreign currency markets, because those are the most liberal open markets there are. And what you'll see is the value of the dollar versus the value of the yen, say, will go up and down by 20%. Now, you don't see 20% fluctuations in the value of what an American or Japanese worker would produce in an hour. You don't see 20% differences in the value, say, of a glass of water in Japan or a glass of water in the United States. These are pure fluctuations that have nothing to do with anything, because markets themselves are highly speculative. They depend upon the view of the future. That's why the NASDAQ stock market went up so much, because people were following this rosy view of what they dreamt that the future would be. But of course, we don't have anything solid to base the future on.
Let's talk about the information and the functioning of markets for a second, because one of the things that struck me in the last couple of years, when I used to shop exclusively from Amazon.com, uh-huh. And then about 9 months ago, I got turned on to these Meta book shopping sites where they compare, you know, hundreds of different booksellers.
Yes.
And I've haven't shopped at Amazon.com since, because I find it always for half the price someplace else. Uh-huh. Isn't this one of the dangers for capitalism of more perfect information, that the more perfect price information is in the economy for consumers, the more the marginal rate of profit will be driven down to zero, creating a kind of intrinsic contradiction or crisis?
Yes and no. If you assume that the only people who are using this are the consumers, then you're correct and would be highly unstable. But Hal Varian, who's a dean at the University of California, Berkeley, has discussed this, and he says, you know what's going to happen is that this will be used by the sellers too. And it will give the sellers a way of monitoring what other sellers are doing. That is, you know darn well that if you're working at Delta Airlines or American Airlines, that you're watching what all the other airlines are doing. And you can know instantaneously. Mm-hmm. Where if you're talking about a store over here and a store over there, one store can have a sale, get a few extra customers before the other store matches it. And his view is that what will happen will be that this technology will be developed in such a way that the sellers will monitor each other. And what a big Amazon can do, if they see that Ma and Pa's internet bookstore is dropping the price on a book, is they can drop the price so low that Ma and Pa will have to either go out of business, because Amazon, supposedly, if they're a successful company, which they're not yet, Amazon can afford to continue to lose money to maintain that market, or Ma and Pa will have to know not to lower prices too much, or they'll make Amazon mad, because Amazon's watching them. Mm. So it works both ways. And if it works that way, what it will do would it be to inhibit any seller from going out on a limb and saying, I'm going to cut prices to try to give the consumers a better deal.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know that my competitors are going to do the same thing. And therefore, I won't get any more customers and we'll all have less money.
I'm speaking with
Michael. Did that make sense to you?
It did. I'm speaking with Michael Perlman. He's a professor of economics at California State Chico and author of many books critical of techno-capitalist hype. There's one more point that you brought up when you were talking about the intellectual property dispute, and that is that we all stand, whenever we create anything, we stand on the shoulders of giants. I think of the invention of the spreadsheet, the computer spreadsheet. I think it was called VisiCalc.
And it was VisiCalc, exactly.
Yeah, and it wasn't invented by some California state professors, or I think they were state university professors someplace. Anyway, they didn't patent it. They didn't patent the concept, and it went on to be integral, central to modern industrial capitalism. But
Dan Bricklin was one of the people.
Uh-huh. And if it had been patented, you know, it would have been an empire comparable to Microsoft, I'm sure, in terms of its profitability. But, you know, so that's an example of the kind of the inhibitory effect that these kinds of patents might have. Well, but one of the things is that a lot of these inventions, the Human Genome Project, for example, are the product of public investments in basic research, various kinds of basic education and infrastructure. And then the benefits of that get privatized as intellectual property. So is that another part of your argument?
Yes. Let me tell you a story about this. When Newt Gingrich went to Washington, they start screaming, cut this, cut that, cut this. And they started talking about cutting the National Institute for Health, National Institutes of Health. And Porter Goss John Porter, I think, was the congressman who was the head of the committee. And he says, no, you're out of your mind. You know, in effect, this is a gold mine for the pharmaceutical companies that are supporting us. And Gingrich later wrote a piece talking about how wise he was when they got to Washington that they cut everything, but they didn't cut this because they knew it was that important. It was a piece where he was lobbying for the pharmaceutical companies to get more money into the National Institutes of Health because this is all free research for them. Just 3 days ago, the Wall Street Journal had a wonderful article on the front page about how all these biotech entrepreneurs, what they do is they'll have my company here, and then they'll have my nonprofit foundation here. They go with their nonprofit foundation, and they go to Washington and say, here, I have a nonprofit foundation, and then the research will be given over to the company, and the public will pay through the nose. Now, let me give you an example of how much the public pays. There's a disease called Goucher's disease, and the medicine that will cure this was created by the National Institutes of Health. And what happened was, they asked some scientists at Tufts University to go and do some research for them. And then the scientists were just doing some research for them. Then they took the research, they patented it, because not that many people have this Goucher's disease. Terrible disease where your inside of your body sort of turns to mush. They charge for 1 year's dose $400,000. And they didn't do the research. The government did. $400,000. Now, that's not a cure. You'll have to pay in future years, but you don't have to pay as much as $400,000.
That's fascinating. I want people to go out and get your books. And The Class Warfare in the Information Age, Invention of Capitalism, Transcending the Economy, and Forthcoming Corporate Capture of Creativity. And the corporate capture of creativity is your broadside against this intellectual property issue. And again, I've been speaking with Michael Perlman. I really want to thank you for coming on.
Oh, it's been fun. I enjoy it. I enjoy talking about this stuff. And if someone knows, remembers that thing about turning off the electric sidewalk, let me know.
There'll be links to your website and email to you on our website, www.changesurfer.com, so they can contact you through that.
Yes, thanks. I've been looking at your website. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com.
You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website www.changesurfer.com.